Hello and welcome to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray. Before we get rolling today, I just want to say hello to some of the people I've met this past week. It's been a really wonderful week. The Lord has blessed us in so many ways. Monday, I got to go down to St. Peter and Paul School in Ottawa, Ohio, and do a two-hour in-service with their teachers and staff on the works of mercy and what really makes a Catholic school a Catholic school. So that was so much fun. They were wonderful down there. And yesterday I got to be a part of a Midwest, I think it was called Midwest Chaplain and Mission Integration Conference. So people from all over the Midwest for Catholic Health Initiatives were meeting, and I got to do a presentation on redemptive suffering. And it was great because we had such great interactions with these wonderful ministers who actually work and care for people as they're kind of going through these struggles in their lives, especially at the end of life. So that was a real blessing. And then last night, just to thank the families in Oak Harbor, the parents who came, I'm working with them as they start to prepare their students for confirmation and theology of the body as part of it. So I'm always asking to talk about kind of the foundations of Catholic moral thought so parents can kind of start putting all these things together. And they were wonderful, real concerned about the spiritual health of their children too, which I find very important. So often all we worry about is the physical health, which we need to, but we also need to worry about their spiritual health. And so thanks so much to the parents from Oak Harbor who were there, and I look forward this Sunday to being with the parents in Genoa to do the same presentation to help them as they help their children with their spiritual health. So just wanted to thank all those people and say hello to them if they're listening, because all of that was just a great experience for me. And we're getting ready here for our show that we're doing today, and it's going to be someone that you've heard a number of times. And because I've been busy with these other presentations, he was gracious enough to come in and help me do a show today, because I wasn't able to spend tons of time on research like I try to normally do. So he did the research, and I'm still going to host, but he's going to be talking a lot more probably. And so the voice you will hear is Professor Jim Murray from Lourdes University, also my husband. Hello, dear.
Hello. And this is a little bit discouraging right off the bat.
Why?
So I'm kind of like a filling, you know, I feel like human caulk here. You know, I'm kind of filling in the gaps that you have left.
Sorry, honey.
But I'll do the best I can.
You will never be human caulk to me. You are always brilliant.
That's the nicest thing
brilliant.
I've ever heard. Man.
You can tell how romantic we are, can't you? Yeah, the nice things that we say to one another. You will never be human cock to me. How often have you said that to your spouse? Okay, so today, basically, you know that Jim has, obviously, his background is music, but he also teaches film, music and film at Lourdes University. So he does a lot with film. And so when I come home and see him sitting in front of the TV watching Turner Classics, now he can claim he's doing research. So
I believe now we can take that off our taxes, maybe.
Today I told him, I said, and because you might have remembered when I talked to Deal Hudson, he has a radio show and he does a lot on virtue and culture. And we had seen where he had done some, I think he had chosen some movies that he thought exemplified virtue. And I told Deal at some point I wanted him back on to talk about that. But in the meantime, I thought, you know, well, I'm going to ask Jim, because Jim watches all these movies, and he obviously has an understanding of virtue because I talk about it all the time. So I asked him to kind of compile a list, especially of the cardinal virtues, and if we have time, we'll touch on theological, but movies that he has seen that he thinks exemplifies the cardinal virtues. And so we're going to talk a little bit about those today. So we're going to start off with the virtue of temperance. And if you remember, the virtue of temperance, seen through reason alone, is using innerworldly pleasures well, so in reasonable manner. Now, again, when we add the grace of God to that, it is how do we use our worldly pleasures to build up the kingdom of God. So it takes on a little bit of a different understanding when we add the grace of God. But we want to come back and say, okay, so which one, Jim, did you choose for temperance?
Well, temperance, using worldly pleasures well, there are certainly far more examples of movies that show people not being temperate.
Right.
Not using worldly pleasures well. Movies like Citizen Kane, The Magnificent Ambersons are all examples of movies where people have been blessed with great things, but it becomes their downfall because
right.
they can't deal with it in a way
because they're not temperate.
Right, they're not temperate. The one I picked, though, that's a positive example, I think, and again, there are many, but one that I would recommend the audience see whenever it appears on Turner Classics would be the movie Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. And this is from 1936. It stars Gary Cooper.
Oh, he's really good at
and
that.
And Gene Arthur. Well, Gary Cooper is great because this really is the movie that establishes his screen persona.
Really?
You know, before that, the studios had tried to make him into a suave leading man.
Uh-huh.
And if you think of Gary Cooper now, you think of the common guy fighting against, the evils of the world.
Right.
And this is the movie that really established him in that part, and he continued to play this role for the next, 30 years or so, 25, 30 years.
Okay.
It's directed by Frank Capra, who's an interesting guy, too. Capra is well known in the 30s for making a long string of these, you might want to call spiritual movies. He did Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. He did You Can't Take It With You. He did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Wow.
He did one of my favorites of all time, Meet John Doe. And he also did It's a Wonderful Life.
Right.
So Capra was drawn to stories that showed people struggling with basic morals.
Mm-hmm.
And then always understanding at the end the positive nature and how they could be good people by exemplifying those things.
I find that, you say Frank Capra and I think It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, sure. Everybody
I forget that, he did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Man, that's a great example, too, of prudence
absolutely.
And justice,
sure.
What's the Can't Take It With You?
Well, You Can't Take It With You is a story of this weird family, a family of social, I don't want to say outcasts, but they have their very own peculiar look at life.
Okay.
And Jimmy Stewart and Gene Arthur, I believe, are in that. She's the daughter of the family. He marries, or he's going to marry into this family. She has to introduce him to her family. And for all their weirdness, you come to understand, they understand life better than most everyone else. They live it to its fullest.
Right.
They're kind. They see nothing wrong with giving away everything they own if somebody needs something.
Right.
And everyone else views them as being these eccentrics.
Right.
And so it's the same kind of a thing. Capra is interesting, too, because I always think of Frank Capra as the canary in the cultural coal mine, because his career flourished in the late 20s, 30s, early 40s.
Okay.
But when the culture began to change, his type of picture was quickly labeled as corny,
right.
old-fashioned,
right.
And, not worth people going to see. It's not complex enough.
Yeah.
It deals
kind of the simple pleasures of life.
And so by the 50s, his career is basically over. No one wants to.
Yeah.
No one wants him to make these movies. He's not interested in making anything else.
Yeah.
Because this is what he believes people ought to see.
Ought to see. Yeah.
So Capra's a great example of what we had talked about earlier, in previous shows, of how the culture shifts
right
into away from showing positive things into emphasizing, everything's very gray.
Right.
Capra's a very black and white guy.
Yeah.
But as society moves into that gray area of morality, he falls completely out of favor. But Mr. Deeds Goes to Town is a great example of the way he viewed things.
Okay. And I want to, because I think, we're talking about virtue and how it is exemplified in these films. I really think, you know, when you think of how I understand, you know, when I look at the films that Capra made, he really believes you can call people to be the best, that they can change, that they can become better. In our terms, they can become more virtuous.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, where, you know, and I know people, if you listen to this show regularly, you have heard me like gag at, I think it was Manchester by the Sea or whatever. But that movie that I did walk out of it for a while because I couldn't take it anymore. But it allows the lead character to just it ends with him still being kind of a scumbag and not changing and not finding that he has goodness within him to offer. Well, and that's okay. And that scene is, wow, that's a great movie. You know, that was a great movie. You know, it's like, really? You know?
Well, yeah. And I think this is why there are so many millions of us who love Turner Classic Movies, because we love the movies of the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s, and even into the 60s to an extent, where they told that type of story.
Right.
A story of where the character has an arc, where perhaps they disregard a virtue, but they come to realize their error, they change their ways, and you see the result of that.
Yeah.
There's so many examples of that.
And I didn't want to get you off track, but Capra's a great, I mean, he's just a great example of that, and we've kind of lost that in our
films. We could do a whole show
today,
probably, just on
his films,
his ideas and his theories about
virtue and story. Yeah. Well, tell the audience, just in case they haven't seen Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, give them kind of an understanding of it so we can see how temperance plays here.
Well, it's important to realize that Mr. Deeds Goes to Town was made in 1936, so we're into the Depression. And the plot basically is a wealthy city industrialist dies and leaves $20 million to one of his nephews, Longfellow Deeds. Now, Longfellow lives in Mandrake Falls, Vermont. and so he is an eccentric guy, but he's suddenly inherited this $20 million. He plays the tuba. That's one of his great loves.
Right. Yeah.
His job is to write sayings on greeting cards.
Oh, okay.
And that's a great analogy because if you think of what you read on old fashioned greeting cards, it's very much a simple statement of virtue.
Right.
You know, and so he loves to write those. Well, after inheriting the $20 million, he goes to the city because that's what everybody tells him he has to do, the lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes, a member of all these boards, corporate boards, and everybody trying to get his hands on this money.
Right.
And he doesn't really understand what to do with the money. And so he does. He donates money to the opera, which is putting on radical productions and nobody goes to ever see, and things like that. And so basically what happens eventually is a group of farmers, you'll like this, being from a farming family.
That's right.
A group of farmers come to him in the city and say, you know what, Longfellow, you are completely wasting your life. You've lost track of what you're supposed to do with an excess of blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, you're wasting all this money. You know, there are people out here who have lost their farms. Mm-hmm. There are people out here who can't find a job. There are people down on their luck.
Mm-hmm.
And you have betrayed them all.
Mm.
Longfellow thinks about it for a moment, realizes that you're right. I've kind of gotten swept up in all these city pleasures. So he decides he takes $18 million of his $20 million and he puts it in a fund or a foundation to help any farmer who wants it, no questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
To help anyone down on their luck, no questions asked. And once the city people see him do this, they attempt to have him committed for insanity because they cannot understand that type of charity at all.
Right.
That's totally beyond their understanding.
Right.
He must be crazy.
Right.
And so the end of the movie, he goes on trial to be committed for insanity. He's put on trial.
I don't remember that part.
Yes.
Okay.
And they bring in all these witnesses, particularly these two elderly ladies from Mandrake Falls, who say, absolutely, he's pixelated. That was the word they used.
What does that mean?
Pixelated means he's not quite right. And they go, yes, he's pixelated. And they go, and so they think, oh, now we've proved he's insane.
Right.
And the judge says, well, explain what his pixelated things he does. Oh, well, he helps people. You know, one time there was a cat about to get hit in the street, and he ran out and helped the cat. You know, to them, you know, that's not a bad thing to be pixelated.
Right.
It's good. It means you understand your purpose in life and you help others.
Right.
Eventually, of course, then he's found innocent and he lives happily ever after with Gene Arthur, who's the reporter in the story, who begins by making fun of him. But she also generally then comes around to see, you know, he really understands what life is truly all about.
Yeah.
Now, let me say this, too. There was a remake in early 2000s called Mr. Deeds, Adam Sandler.
Is that Adam Sandler?
Yes.
Okay. What was that?
Well, this is another great example. This remake completely misses the point of the original.
And hard to believe. I don't think they cared for the point of the original. Yeah.
But it indicates, it shows you how culture has shifted.
Yeah.
Adam Sandler viewed the movie and he said, I want to make a remake, but they concentrate basically on his weirdness.
Okay.
If you watch the remake, there's not nearly as much about the use
helping
of the money.
Others.
Helping.
Yeah.
It's more like, well, he's crazy. And we're going to, and you know, he does lots of really crazy things.
Right.
And it's oriented more towards the comedy of his craziness rather than what Capra saw in the story, which was this is a chance to show people,
who's really crazy.
Who's really crazy.
Yeah.
And to show people how to look at life in the correct way.
Right.
Now, nowadays in films, no one would dare try to tell someone what the correct way to look at life is.
Yeah.
But back in the 30s and the 40s in those movies, that was almost the point of the movie.
That was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, you know, and I think that's, and we talked about, you know, media before and how it changed and how movies changed over the years. But I think there was this sense that back in those days, there was certainly this sense of an objective right and wrong. There is a better way of living. There is one lifestyle that is better than another, where now you can't make those statements because, you're being judgmental, or who are you to say that's the best way to live, that kind of thing, because we just don't do it.
And that's why Capra's career eventually ends because he views the purpose of film is to tell stories that result in people leaving the theater, perhaps with a different point of view of how to be better.
Right. And I think that's the key on how to be more virtuous. That, you know, when you're given these kinds of blessings, like Mr. Deeds was, you know, what are you? And I think, you know, that it shows that there are people who basically just see him as a means to an end, who just want to use him for his money. And he being of kind of a naive, innocent character can't recognize that.
Well, and again, the cultural things Capra always plays out in his film. There's a wonderful scene in this movie where Gary Cooper is in the city. He goes to eat dinner, and he's introduced to these famous poets.
Mm-hmm.
And he's thrilled because he writes greeting card poetry.
Right.
And he kind of feels, well, we're all kind of working at the same thing. And these famous poets from the city ridicule him mercilessly because his sentiment is so old-fashioned. Yeah. And, you know, you need to write things like that don't rhyme. And so you get that cultural clash.
Right.
And he is and it breaks Mr. Deeds' heart.
Right.
To think that, well, these people don't even respect what I do, but mm-hmm. millions of people buy these cards every year.
Exactly.
And love what I do, but I must be doing something wrong because these elites don't
appreciate it.
So there's so much in this movie. Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, if you ever get a chance to see it, check it out. It's on Turner every once in a while.
Yeah, and I remember I never really, I mean, you're the movie guy in the family. I kind of, you know, come in and out of them as you're watching them sometimes. But unfortunately, I used to always get Gary Cooper mixed up with Robert Mitchum. I think Robert Mitchum.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I know, hard to believe.
They're complete polar opposites.
And so I remember that one really spooky movie that Robert Mitchum played, the cowboy that lurked outside. Wasn't it the granny's house?
Night of the Hunter.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That just scared me to death.
That's
and for a
wonderful
long time,
movie.
Oh, and so for a long time, you'd say Gary Cooper, and somehow I thought he was in that movie.
Well,
then I watched Mr. Deeds, yeah. And I'm like, oh, this guy's great. I love Gary Cooper.
Well, Gary Cooper had a great career, and his career is very similar in arc to Jimmy Stewart.
Okay.
They both kind of inhabited that same area.
Right. Time frame.
Stewart, after World War II, transitioned much better into the more ambiguous kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 50s, he had a great 10-year stretch in the 50s, Jimmy Stewart did. But Cooper never really made that transition.
Yeah, he always played kind of the same guy, but it was a great, great one.
One of the quotes from Mr. Deeds before we leave the movie.
Yeah.
Gary Cooper says, "People here are funny. They're talking about the city. They work so hard at living, they forget how to live." I always like that quote.
That's a great line. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Okay, well, even though we've told you a lot about Mr. Deeds, you will still enjoy it. So Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, 1930s movie with Gary Cooper. Great one for understanding temperance, but really understanding a lot of, I think, of the cardinal virtues that come into play there, because obviously he had to gain some prudence as he went through to figure out how to do things, which leads us we're going to talk about kind of two virtues at once here, because we're going to talk about prudence and justice. And if you remember, prudence is seeking the truth so that one can do the good, and justice is giving one their due or trying to be in right. How do we reckon right relationships or be in right relationships? And again, we're talking about them as cardinal virtues through the lens of reason. But certainly we know when we add the grace of God there, we are always seeking how God helps us know truth and what it really means to be in right relationship with God himself. So what movies are we going to talk about here as we jump into these?
I think when you look at prudence seeking the truth, your mind immediately goes to movies featuring trials.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a great many trial movies to choose from. And again, the trial movies exemplify what we've already talked about in the sense that over the years, they begin to change.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, 30s, 40s, your trial movies arrived at a conclusion.
Right.
By that, I mean,
they got to the truth.
They got to the truth. Evil was punished. Good was rewarded.
And that's justice was done. People got their due.
Yes. But as we go into the 50s, 60s, and onward, we begin to see trial movies that don't arrive at the truth. They come to a verdict, but you're never right. You're never sure if the verdict is the right verdict, if it's true.
If it's true.
If it's not, they tend to value in these later trial movies. They tend to value ambiguity again.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they did it, but maybe they didn't.
Right.
They said they didn't, but maybe they didn't.
Yeah.
So you get that. It's that arc of culture that you can see even in these trial movies.
And without being able to get to the truth, it is hard to have justice. I mean, you don't know what someone is due unless you know the truth.
Right.
And so when people aren't concerned about getting to the truth, when they're just concerned with an agenda or something else, then justice is never served. And I think, we're certainly struggling a lot with that in our society.
Right, yeah.
So tell me, what kind of movies did you talk about
for
here?
For this, I picked a really obscure movie.
Okay.
It's a movie called The Winslow Boy. And it's obscure not because it isn't good. It's a wonderful movie to watch. It's obscure because it's never been put on DVD. It's not a movie you can go and find.
Mm-hmm.
Turner will run it every once in a while. But it's a wonderful movie. It's from 1948, stars Robert Donat, who is a British star who never translated over into Hollywood. He had a lot of health problems, had to stay in England. When he came to Hollywood, his health problems, asthma, things like that, got so bad he couldn't stay. But he was a wonderful star in the 30s and 40s. And it tells a story of, it's a trial movie. It tells the story of a young boy from a prominent family who goes off to a naval preparatory boarding school to get ready for a career in the British Navy. But he is thrown out. He's accused of a very petty crime. I think it's something like stealing a postal order or some stamps or something. Mm-hmm. But it's a very strict moral code.
Right.
They expel him. He claims, the boy claims he didn't do it. But the boarding school does not afford him a trial, doesn't afford him any type of justice. They simply say, we have an understanding that we think this is what happened, so you're out.
Mm-hmm.
His family then hires a lawyer to clear his son's name.
Right.
And this is basically the plot of the movie.
Okay.
Where the rest of the movie then is presenting witnesses, trying to arrive at the truth.
Okay.
The problem with it is that because this is a government school, so to speak, a naval school,
right.
England had the rule that you cannot sue the government. The king cannot be sued.
Right.
So that was the first thing that had to be overcome. They win that. They get the right to take it to trial. And then by simply applying rules of evidence, it's basically proven the boy didn't do it.
Okay.
And he is then exonerated.
Right.
Yeah, he found innocent. But what's interesting is...
Okay, I'm going to
hold
you there because we are coming up on break.
Oh, boy, so, we can start with that after break.
Okay. So just to let our audience know, you're listening to The Virtuous Life. Today, my guest is Professor Jim Murray, also my husband from Lourdes University. He is speaking about how good movies that exemplify the virtues. And so we've talked about temperance. We're into prudence and justice right now. So join us on the other side of the break and continue to listen. What good movies are out there to help you understand these virtues? I'm Pat Odie Murray, your host of The Virtuous Life. See you on the other side of the break.
Catholic Faith Journeys offers custom pilgrimages to fit the travel desires and spiritual needs of your group to destinations that enhance, teach, and proclaim the gospel. France, Italy, Poland, Greece, Rome, and the Holy Land, and many other sites. Tell Catholic Faith Journeys where your parish or other group would like to go, and they can make it a reality. Open pilgrimages are detailed at www.catholicfaithjourneys.com.
As you get ready for the weekend, we'll get you up to speed on what's happening in and around the diocese. Add some Catholic clarity on the day's news and share a few laughs. Join Chris, Deacon Joe, and me, Deacon Mike Learned, for Annunciation Radio Presents. We're live from 8 to 9 a.m. every Friday, so it's always topical, informative, and fun. Wake up and listen in Friday morning on Annunciation Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray. And today, my husband has come in. He's graciously consented to help me out today. It was a crazy week for me, so I couldn't do a lot of research for stuff. And he is bringing a wealth of knowledge about movies because he teaches music and film. He is a music person, music major, but he does this class at Lourdes, music and film. And so he is very familiar with a lot of film. So I said, yeah, let's talk about movies that are, that exemplify the virtues. So like if I'm trying to teach my kids something about a certain virtue or I want to know more about it, is there a good movie I can go see? Now, granted, we're talking about older movies here. The problem is it's hard sometimes to find new movies that exemplify virtues. They usually show us more things we shouldn't be doing. So my guest today, he did all the work. So I'm kind of along for the ride today. welcome back, Jim. Thanks so much.
It's great to be back. Great to be back.
So we were in the midst of talking about prudence and justice. We talked about temperance in the first part of the show. Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, the original with Gary Cooper. Then we talked, we're talking now about trial movies, and before the break you explained an older movie called The Winslow Boy. Right?
Winslow Boy, yeah. It's
Winslow Boy.
Oh, and a wonderful but obscure movie.
And you talked about, you kind of gave us the, you know, the background, what it was
right.
all about, why, what it has to do with prudence and justice. And then you were going to go into another very specific point when I stopped you for the break. So go to it.
Okay. Well, of course, in The Winslow Boy, and again, I recommend you see it. You'll love this movie. We have the basic plot that the boy wrongly accused is exonerated. But what makes this a great movie, in my view, is all of the subtleties that are brought in. For example, the boy and his family are victorious. They are exonerated and proven that they were innocent. But the movie makes very clear that every character in the movie on the winning side loses something
mm-hmm.
in that struggle.
Right.
The son who's exonerated, the family has spent all their money on this. He can't go to college. So
right.
he loses his chance to go to a really high-class college. The daughter in the family who defends her brother is an social outcast. Her marriage, her fiancé throws her overboard because she is fighting this fight for justice. She loses. The father, who is very energetic in the beginning of the movie, this wears him down
sure.
to the point where he is a decrepit old man at the end. So he loses.
Mm-hmm.
So I like how it shows that you can fight for the right, but there is going to be a price you pay.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come easy.
Right.
It's not something where it's all lollipops and flowers. Oh,
right.
I won. Everything, the world is right. Everything's wonderful.
Right.
It's that level of layering of motivations and things in this movie, The Winslow Boy, that really make it fun for me to watch.
So when we talk about this seeking the truth, right, that so that, you know, like you said, in trial movies and certainly in life, we should always be about trying to seek the truth. What is the truth? So often in trial movies, it comes down to whether the witnesses, right, are truthful themselves, that step forward to either corroborate the stories or not. Or just, you know, the defense who says, I didn't do that, and they've got witnesses. In this story, Jim, and I will admit I've never seen The Winslow Boy. So in this story, how effective is that search for truth? I mean, is it very clear that they have made a convincing case, not just a compelling case, but a convincing case that this young man is innocent?
Yes, it's pretty. I mean, I think at the end of the movie, there's really no doubt that the boarding school acted hastily and didn't afford this young man justice at that time.
Okay.
Justice had to be pursued and, you know, through
yeah.
later developments. It's interesting, too, and again, these older movies are not afraid of subtlety and not afraid of different layering of motivations. But at one point at the end, when the boy has been exonerated, Robert Donat, who plays the lawyer who's done this, someone says to him, well, this is a great conclusion, isn't it? You know, justice has been done.
Right.
And he has this brief speech, which is a wonderful speech, where he says, you know, right has been done, not justice. He says, justice is easy. It's simply facts and disputes. Right is hard to arrive at.
Mm.
What is right is hard to arrive at. He says, what we have done is establish that the right thing to do is to allow the boy back into school. But so that idea that, you know, right has been done, but, you know, justice, not necessarily. Justice is a totally different thing than right. And so it gets into this area of, well, sometimes a guilty man goes free. Now, justice has been done in a civil sense, in the sense that there was a trial.
Not in a virtuous sense.
In a civil sense. You know, I think, and that's what he's referring to. You know, sometimes a guilty man goes
free. You've gone through the
justice has been done, but right has not been done.
Right.
And so our civil procedure to arrive at justice is totally different than what you would call probably the theological procedure of arriving at justice. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think what, if I'm correct here, you're saying that this character says that if you go through the legal proceedings the way it is set up, the form, then you have done justice.
Yes, yes.
But we would say in the cardinal virtue of justice, we'd be saying that it is only right if it's based on truth. It is only justice if it's based on truth. So it's not true. It's not a true virtue of justice unless right has been done.
Right.
Because that right, yeah. Because that involves prudence. Prudence is I need the truth so that I can do right. And justice would be. It's more than just going through steps of a procedure. That might be civil justice. But virtue, the virtue of justice is I have to have the truth in order for it to be the virtue of justice, true justice. That's why sometimes you hear when someone who has been in prison for some time and then all of a sudden it's found, you know, that they were innocent. Somebody else steps up or they find DNA now and it says it wasn't that guy. You'll hear people say justice has finally been done or justice has finally been served.
Right.
So what they're saying is the truth has finally come out. And that's why in our day and age, you cannot, well, in life in general, not our day and age, but you can't separate truth from justice. You just can't. It has to be a part of it because even with, you know, even in personal relationships, outside of any kind of crime, parents have to know the truth of what their child did or didn't do so that they can give him his due.
Yeah.
You know, which is justice. You know, who broke the lamp? Right. And, you know, and in school, when somebody did something wrong, well, okay, everybody's going to sit here until somebody fesses up, you know, so it's kind of, well, we're just going to punish everybody.
I lost a lot of recess in elementary school on that legal procedure.
That's right. But that's not giving the person their due. But that's why truth is so important that, you know, that's what we tend to do in our human capacity is, well, okay, this is how we're going to get to the truth. We're going to make you all sit here until somebody fesses up. That's how we get to the truth. So, but it really is an injustice, but it's a tool we use to try to get to truth because truth is imperative. And I go over and over this with my students all the time because I see it so much in our society today that people do not think twice about saying things that are not true. Or making conjectures about something of which they have no real understanding. And it smears people, it harms people's lives. And even in this story that you talked about, the Winslow boy, just that accusation, even though he was proved innocent, that accusation took a toll on that family.
Yes, there was a price to be paid for pursuing it. And so, you know, the movie makes clear that you have a decision to make if you're going to pursue the truth. You need to understand that it's not going to be easy.
And the other piece I think that we see in our society today and always angers me, but it happens all the time, when people just pay somebody off. You know, somebody makes a claim and they know it's false. But they don't want to go through the hassle and the, you know, of what this family did, right? They just, let's pay them off. Well, that's like saying you did it, you know, but you understand they don't want to drag it out. You know, I see it even in institutions that'll pay because they don't want to go through seeking the truth because it is so hard and is so difficult to prove. A lot of times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean,
I get a little furious about
this. No, that's fine.
Truth is so important.
We're talking about, you know, trial movies. So I would recommend you go look out for the Winslow Boy. I think the entire movie is in YouTube.
Okay.
But it's an obscure film, but you will enjoy it tremendously. At the opposite end of the trial movies, we have 1959, and I would use Anatomy of a Murder as an example of
Who's in that? That's
Jimmy Stewart.
Okay, that is what I'm thinking.
Ben Gazzara, Lee Remick.
Okay,
but this is where this is just to show where culture has gone. This is a movie that never arrives at anything.
You don't know what's true.
You never do. To piggyback on what we just talked about, justice is done. A trial is held. There's a dispute whether a woman, a wife, has been raped. And as a result, did the husband kill the man who did it?
Oh, yeah, okay, I remember that movie, yeah.
Or did the man simply beat up his wife?
Right.
Because she was out with another man.
Right.
It's a great example of that ambiguity. We find that a verdict is reached. The man who did the killing,
the husband, right,
is found innocent,
right.
But it's clear throughout the film, if you watch it carefully, it's pretty clear that he did it. I mean,
he knew that he was fooling around with his wife.
So justice is done.
Right,
a verdict is reached. However, we're not sure that right has been done.
Yeah, justice. And it's, the theological virtue of justice has not been done.
Right.
Yeah. So, or
civil justice has been done.
Yeah.
Civil justice has been done.
Yeah.
But it's obvious in Anatomy of a Murder, right is never arrived at.
Right.
And that's a great example of trial movies nowadays. In the last, 30, 40 years, that is what Hollywood finds compelling,
right?
The ambiguity.
Right.
They don't want to come down on the side of the questions like the Winslow Boy did in 1948, but they want to leave it up in the air. You decide.
Right? Yeah. You decide.
You know, the truth is what you think it is, and that that is a slippery slope. But movies reflect that in the culture.
But I will give some of those movies a pass in the sense that it is very hard in many cases to get to the truth because so many things are he said, she said, or there are no witnesses, or the witnesses remember things incorrectly. I can give them sometimes a pass on the ambiguity in those films about kind of leaving it up to you. What do you think? But not to the point where that the truth is irrelevant. I think of Chicago. Remember the movie Chicago?
Yeah,
if you watch the movie Chicago, I'm talking about the recent one years ago with Renee Zellweger and those.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you just come out of there thinking, oh my gosh, the justice system, is so messed up. I mean, because lawyers they're not interested in the truth.
Right.
They're not interested in the truth at all. And this movie shows that. And I'm not saying that about lawyers in general, but there is a sense, right? That the cardinal virtue of justice will only be as good as what prudence is, what truth is, and will only be as good as the people, the people's character who are involved in the situation.
Right.
Legal teams and individuals.
And you make a good point. In Anatomy of a Murder, every person involved in the trial, every witness, every participant, they're all highly flawed people.
Right. Their moral characters.
Their moral characters are highly flawed. So it is very difficult to know what
Trust? Who's telling the truth?
You really can't. Yeah. So, but look at the Winslow Boy for the people in your audience, and you'll enjoy it. It's a great movie.
Let's move to the last cardinal virtue, which is fortitude. And again, under the realm of cardinal virtues, virtues known by reason alone, it's facing difficulties well in this life, in this world. When we talk about them as infused cardinal virtues, the idea that we add the grace of God to our reason, it's facing difficulties for the love of God. Okay, so it changes our goal, not just about facing difficulties well in this world, but actually facing it for the love of God. So let's talk a little bit about fortitude.
Well, with fortitude, I'm going to use a movie that's one of my personal favorites. I love this movie so much that your radio host here, when she comes out and sees me watching it for the zillionth time, just rolls her eyes and doesn't understand it all. This is the movie, the John Ford movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, from 1962. Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, and Vera Miles.
Somehow I knew. I didn't know how The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance would make it into this conversation, but I knew it would.
Oh, yes. You can't get past the man. But, again, John Ford is a filmmaker much like Frank Capra, who specialized largely in Westerns, but not exclusively. But all of his movies take a very wonderful approach to personal virtue in their characters and how characters evolve to come to the correct place.
And he was basically cowboy movies, right?
Basically John Ford, cowboy Western movies. But he made lots of other wonderful movies. He made The Informer, which is a movie from 1935, which is a wonderful movie about the Irish British conflict.
Okay.
He made The Quiet Man.
Oh, okay.
He made, so there are other movies.
Yeah, there are others.
Too.
Okay. I didn't mean to get you off track.
Yeah, but The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is primarily concerned with the question of how do you face difficulty, or more precisely, what's the correct way to face evil? It sets up the premise of two men, Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, who are both confronted with the same evil, Liberty Valance, who's the bad guy.
Okay.
Jimmy Stewart is personally victimized. He's beaten up, pistol whipped, robbed by Liberty Valance. And so he has a reason to face this difficulty. Jimmy Stewart's position is civilization should face evil in the sense that justice or the law or trying to civilize evil is the way to transform it into good.
Okay. So kind of a conversion process.
A conversion process, so to speak.
Okay.
John Wayne's theory is no, evil cannot be converted. It is evil, and it must be faced head on, and it must be defeated and done away with.
And destroyed.
And destroyed. Mm-hmm. So the whole movie basically examines both of those approaches. So you have Jimmy Stewart, who comes into the town that's being terrorized by Liberty Valance, and he's going to set up a lawyer thing. He's going to get evidence. He's going to try to get witnesses, and he's going to bring Liberty Valance to trial in a civilized manner.
Mm-hmm.
And John Wayne says, no, eventually somebody's going to have to walk down the street with a gun and have a shootout with this guy, or you'll never be rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so
is Jimmy Stewart he is a lawyer.
He is a lawyer, yes.
Okay. And John Wayne is a?
He's a rancher. He's a guy who just lives in the town.
All right.
And he's a rancher. The audience is given a character. Ford often does this in his movies. The audience is given a character to relate to, and that's Vera Miles, who's the daughter of the restaurant owner, who loves both of these men.
Mm-hmm.
She loves Jimmy Stewart when he comes to town because she understands that civilization has a place.
Right.
It's important. She falls in love with that concept. But she also, at the same time, loves John Wayne because she understands you have to be strong in the face of evil.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just talk to evil. You can't just prosecute it.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And so she is the audience in the film. And we watch her go back and forth and back and forth.
Oh, that's interesting.
And eventually, she marries Jimmy Stewart. So eventually, civilization wins.
Right.
But John Ford makes a strong case that if it weren't for people like John Wayne facing down evil, we would have a huge, huge problem.
Right.
You can see John Wayne as an analogy maybe for the military.
Right.
I think of the...
kind of the just war theory was what was in my head because I'm getting ready to teach it here in a couple
now,
of days.
Now, what is interesting, if you want to look at the other side of this, this is the man who shot Liberty Valance. The other side of this argument would be a few good men. Jack Nicholson, you need me standing on that wall,
right,
facing down evil.
Right.
He's clearly portrayed in that film as just as bad,
right,
as the evil.
But in that film, he is doing things that are evil.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, right.
He's not sacrificing himself to take out evil. He's really perpetuating evil. So there's a difference, I think.
But I think with Jack Nicholson, his argument is, you know, you need to do what you need to do to defeat evil.
Right.
John Wayne would make the same argument. You need to do what you need to do.
Right.
You need to face it down and destroy it.
Right.
So in the end, Jimmy Stewart confronts Liberty Valance in a shootout and believes he has shot Liberty Valance.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert.
It's an old movie.
It's an old movie. But he believes he is, and he becomes a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he becomes a hero not for pursuing the civilized approach.
Yeah, right.
He becomes a hero for facing it down.
Right.
And so he becomes a hero to the town. He's elected to state senator. He rises to great political power. But we learn later, in fact, John Wayne, hiding in the shadows, was actually the man who shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah.
So we think, the subtlety that Ford presents in his film, which makes it so neat. We think... We're led to believe that civilization will get the job done, but ultimately, you've got to destroy it face to face.
Yeah, and I think that that is kind of what we talk about with the just war theory on a microcosm, right? I mean, in the old Wild West, you know, when there weren't necessarily ways to control, or maybe there wasn't even sheriffs in some of these towns,
right,
and these guys come in. You know, what do you do with them?
You know,
you don't have a jail. You don't have obviously we have gone, in civilization, have figured out a way to try to control evil without shooting people in the streets, that we find a way to contain them. But part of, I think, civilization is that idea that Jimmy Stewart's character, that it's not enough to contain criminals, but there has to be a conversion process to it. You know, there has to be some type of reformation of these individuals, because we don't write people off as evil. You know, we say they do evil things. But every person is created in the image of God. And so they are inherently good, but are attracted to evil and choose evil for very selfish means usually. So again, that is why, we just don't shoot people when they're doing something wrong, right? Because it's inherently we believe they are good. And so our job is to kind of what Jimmy Stewart was, by bringing people to justice, we are, with truth and saying, okay, this is what needs to change in order for you to engage society in a positive way and to fulfill who you're made in the image of God, even if they don't believe in God. But I mean, it's that sense.
Yeah, and I think it would have been wonderful if you had been present in the story meetings leading up to making this movie, because it may have been an even better movie. It's hard to understand, hard to believe.
1962, I would have been like second grade. I don't think I'd have thought this deeply.
Because the character of Liberty Valance, played by Lee Marvin.
Uh-huh. He plays that well.
Yeah. That is a purely evil person.
Yep.
It's made plain that there is no reformation there.
Right.
However, you might have an even better movie if you insert a couple scenes that indicate, well, maybe Liberty Valance could be redeemed.
Yeah.
Now, Ford doesn't do that. He says he's black and white,
right.
Evil.
Right.
But think of how that movie would have even a deeper wrinkle if the argument then comes down to, should we try to reform that guy,
right.
Or is he beyond that?
Yeah, is he beyond that redemption?
That's a totally different argument,
yeah,
than what Ford makes in The,
right,
Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Well, if he has to go in that direction with that kind of a layout. You know, if you're going to have this,
yes,
if you're not going to look at Liberty Valance as a person, but as a personification of,
yes,
evil.
That's a good way of putting it.
That's a different way.
Yes.
And that's kind of what he did.
Well,
Lee Marvin, Liberty Valance is just personification of evil.
Yes.
Not a human being.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And you find that in the Western,
right,
genre, that is the way
bad
you
guy,
do
good
things.
Guy. Yeah.
There are movies in the 50s, Westerns, that begin to present that point of view,
mm-hmm,
of, well, you know, these are bad guys, but they had problems too, but they,
right,
have good sides too.
Right.
You know, you look at movies by Anthony Mann, some of the Jimmy Stewart Westerns in the 50s present much more complex evil characters and,
right,
good characters too.
Right. Well, and again, facing difficulties, well, that certainly is part of fortitude, you know, and again, if you remember, you can't really have one of these cardinal virtues without the other. And that's why we always say prudence is the charioteer of all the virtues, because even fortitude, you gotta know truth in order to know, is this where I plant my flag, right? Because you don't want to encounter difficulty for a lie, right? That you don't want to stand up for something that is a lie. So it is, again, we talk about prudence as the charioteer, but it certainly is this sense of fortitude. How do we face our difficulties in life? Well, we've been kind of talking, this has been a good look at these four cardinal virtues. And not just talking about them through the lens of film, but the films help us understand how these are all tied together. Well, maybe we can come back again sometime and do some more with film, and maybe even do some with maybe more modern films. I want to thank Jim. Thanks so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it. We've been talking to Jim Murray, professor of, at Lord's University. He does a film and music class. So
I've enjoyed it tremendously, Pat.
And you have been listening to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray. Have a virtuous week ahead.
The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance. He was the bravest of them all.